From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And I'm Lisa Mullins. It's Here and Now. President Trump returns to Washington from Ireland today, and he has a big decision ahead of him, whether to follow through on his threat to impose tariffs on Mexico Monday over the objections of a number of Republicans.
We're also watching the news that last night, former Vice President and current presidential candidate Joe Biden backtracked on abortion restrictions that he once supported as he comes under increasing pressure from rivals in the 2020 presidential race. So let's bring in our Friday Politics Roundtable, Jesse Holland, who reports for the Associated Press and is a host at C-SPAN. Hi, Jesse.
Hey, how you doing?
Doing well. And Ron Elving, NPR Senior Washington Editor and Correspondent. Hi, Ron.
Good to be with you, Jeremy.
So we're going to do something that we haven't done yet this entire season in this weekly conversation, which was we're actually going to start with the 2020 race and Joe Biden, who, as you know, is a devout Catholic. He's long supported legislation known as the Hyde Amendment, which bars federal funding, federal programs such as Medicaid and Medicare from paying for abortions. Last night at a fundraising event, though, Biden changed his stance.
We now see so many Republican governors denying health care to millions of the most poorest and most vulnerable Americans by refusing even Medicaid expansion. I can't justify leaving millions of women without access to the care they need and the ability to exercise their constitutionally protected right.
Ron, is this shift going to be a problem for Biden? It follows his campaign confirming just days earlier that he supports the Hyde Amendment.
It may be a problem for him with pro-life Democrats. They saw him as something of an island in a sea of opposition within the Democratic Party. They thought Joe Biden was somebody who, while he wasn't entirely with them, at least was with them on the Hyde Amendment, and now they've lost him on that. But we must say that pro-life Democrats are themselves rather isolated in the party, as we've seen, and all polling shows Democrats are increasingly uniform on support for the Hyde Amendment as well as for abortion rights in general.
But Jesse, I remember back to John Kerry in the 2004 race being called a flip-flopper for changing positions on the Iraq War. Is Biden going to have the same problem with getting that label on him?
Well, this is the problem Democrats face with running a longtime politician, that the not only has the country changed, his own party has changed. There used to be a place in a presidential race for a Democrat who was pro-life, but there really isn't a place for that candidate anymore. The way the party has changed and the way that abortion laws have changed in the United States, there really is no position, no place for a pro-life Democratic presidential candidate right now. And Biden just acknowledging this reality. But once again, this is a problem you have with running a longtime politician in a presidential race. You're going to come up with votes from the past that made sense that today just doesn't make sense at all for those candidates. And so you're going to see that with these longtime politicians in the Democratic Party over and over.
We should say that a new NPR PBS NewsHour Marist poll finds that a solid majority of Americans want the Supreme Court to keep the decision upholding abortion rights Roe versus Wade in place. 53% say they would definitely not vote for a presidential candidate who would appoint judges to the Supreme Court who would limit or overturn Roe versus Wade. I want to turn now, though, to tariffs. Amid reports that the president may declare a second national emergency on border security, White House official Mark Short told Fox News that the White House is encouraged about the talks to avoid tariffs on Mexico, but still there's a ways to go.
As of now, the administration is moving forward with plans to notice that so that they would go into effect Monday. But even if that's noticed today, the president should have some flexibility if he wishes, depending on negotiations through the weekend, to delay that.
Jesse Holland, what do you make of the talks and whether or not the president is really going to make good on his threat?
Well, I've learned a long time ago, predicting what this White House is going to do is a futile thing to try to do. But one thing that we're seeing is that Republicans in the Senate are not very happy with this idea of tariffs on Mexico. And that is where the fight is right now between the White House and the Republicans in the Senate. If he can't convince Republicans in his own party in the Senate to go along with this, it doesn't matter. He's going to have to try to do something around Congress like a national emergency because he won't be able to do it through Congress. So what we're going to see is the president putting pressure on his allies, Republicans in the Senate, who are worried about their own farmers and businesses in their district. This is a local issue for them. For the president, it's a national issue.
And Ron Elving, what do you make of the idea that the president is using the threat of tariffs to handle a huge issue around immigration, conflating the two?
That annoys economists, and it annoys those Senate Republicans greatly. They're already somewhat opposed to his tariff views, also some in the House, although they do tend to stand with the president more in lockstep. I think the key word in what Mark Short just said in that quote that you played is the next-to-last word, delay. I think that that word coming into the conversation at this point with about 48 hours to go is key. We should watch for the administration to say, we don't have everything we want from Mexico yet. We're still planning to go ahead with these tariffs, but we're going to delay them by so many days, so many weeks, so many hours, but something that gives them a little more wiggle room while they continue to negotiate with Mexico and look for something that may be a fig leaf in the end, but look for something they can call victory.
But, Ron, don't they risk their losing their credibility on the world stage when they keep doing this? If they don't go through with the tariffs, you know, it was just a couple months ago that they said that they were going to – the White House said that they're going to shut down the whole Mexican border if Mexico doesn't stop all illegal immigration in 1 week. And then, of course, they didn't do that.
And then there was the threat to, in some sense or another, confront Iran, which completely went away
right.
A matter of days later when the president said, no, we're not going to have some sort of military confrontation. And back a little bit further, some of the talk about North Korea that then turned into a contest to see who could throw the most bouquets of favorable language back and forth between the president and Kim Jong-un. So we've seen this kind of behavior before. It maximizes the president's sort of threat factor, if you will, bluster factor, and then at some point or another he negotiates.
Okay, I want to listen to a little bit of what happened this week in Europe. President Trump was there. He gave a speech that was widely praised. Some people are calling it one of the best speeches of his presidency about veterans who invaded Nazi-occupied France 75 years ago on D-Day.
They came here and saved freedom. And then they went home and showed us all what freedom is all about.
And then, you know, he gave a number of interviews while he was overseas, including in a British TV interview where he, who is a climate change skeptic, the president is, described what most impressed him in his discussion about climate change with Prince Charles, who is an environmental advocate.
He doesn't have to worry about future generations in theory unless he's a very good person who cares about people. And that's what impressed me maybe the most, his love for this world.
Jesse, did we learn anything new about President Trump while he was in Europe?
Well, I think nothing changed for Americans about American Trump, about President Trump while he was in Europe. The people who love him still love him, and the people who don't like him still don't like him. One of the things that we have to keep in mind when President Trump travels overseas is that he is acting as the American president, and he represents all of us. But President Trump also made sure that he kept his political hat on. In addition to talking with Prince Charles, he also lobbed some attacks at his Democratic critics like Nancy Pelosi. He had these several controversial tweets where he took on issues that had nothing to do with Normandy and D-Day. So even when he's overseas representing the entire country, President Trump continues to act as a politician and pushing his agenda. At one time, America politics ended at the nation's shores, but we didn't see any of that this time around. President Trump is in full President Trump attack mode no matter where he is.
Well, he was when he was at the American Cemetery in Normandy. In a Fox interview, he called Russia investigation special counsel Robert Mueller a fool and House Speaker Nancy Pelosi a disaster for pursuing investigations of possible obstruction of justice. This is what Nancy Pelosi said this week about pursuing investigations instead of impeachment for now.
Make no mistake. We know exactly what path we're on. We know exactly what actions we need to take. And while that may take more time than some people want it to take, I respect their impatience.
So she said, Ron Elving, she respects their impatience. At this point, how much pressure is on Pelosi, and what is the thrust of the movement for or against impeachment?
The number of Democrats in the House who say they are ready to go into an impeachment proceeding, that is really start to seriously impeach the president, has reached about the 60 level, but that's out of 230-some. So it's still only about a quarter of her caucus. And she needs to pay more attention to three-fourths of her caucus than she does to one-fourth, even if that one-fourth is a good deal noisier and even if it's more representative of what you see on Twitter and what you see among Democratic hardcore activists who would really like to proceed with impeachment now and put some sort of a mark on the president, even if ultimately he can't be removed from office because the Senate refuses to even discuss taking up any charges of impeachment at this point. So she wants to continue to investigate and expose and come up with things that might actually lead to something could be impeachment.
That's Ron Elving, NPR senior Washington editor and correspondent. We've also been speaking with Jesse Holland, who reports for the Associated Press and is a host at C-SPAN. Thanks to both of you. Have a great weekend.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Support for Here and Now and the following message come from Emberwave, the revolutionary new personal thermostat. Ever wish feeling too hot or too cold were optional? As summer heats up outside, just press for a thermal wave designed to provide cooling relief. Over air-conditioned inside? Leave that sweater in the car and rely on Emberwave instead. Learn more at emberwave.com and use code NPR to save $50 at checkout. Emberwave, control your comfort.
Yesterday, parts of Texas and Louisiana were drenched with a month's worth of rain in 24 hours. Rain and snowmelt has flooded homes and farms across the Midwest and southern United States since early spring. Near Vicksburg, Mississippi, the Mississippi River has been above flood stage for 110 days. Here and Now's Peter O'Dowd has been reporting this week in the Mississippi Delta, where the suffering has been as unrelenting as the rising water.
Don't let the peaceful sounds of the Yazoo backwater deceive you. This place has become a wasteland.
Animals are starving. You go by and you see one standing on the side of the road or in some woods eating grass is sticking out of the water, and their hip bones are sticking out, their backbones.
Yeah, I've seen it. It's crazy.
It's bad.
Eddie Hatcher is an Issaquena County Commissioner. We spoke at his home on a 94-degree burner of a day in the Mississippi Delta. There will be no corn this year for many farmers here. No soybeans, no cotton, no income.
How much of your county is underwater?
I've got 86 miles of county roads. And if you took every little dry spot that's not underwater, out of 86 miles, I might have a mile and a half that's not underwater. People don't understand just how bad this is until they come see this damage.
Today, we will see the damage up close, starting here at the edge of a farm road that disappears into the flood. It's where I met Anderson Jones. He's going home to find his dogs.
I had to leave my dog behind because they really guard that house. You know, my dog guard the house and guard me, too.
Anderson is 59 and walks with a brace on his left leg. The house he left was the house he grew up in. Friends had helped him build a wall of sandbags around it as the water rose, but the makeshift levee didn't hold.
I wasn't going to leave until the water practically get in my house, and it did get in my house, made it 19 when my son was there, and I had to leave.
So from late February to late May, you tried to stay.
I tried to stay and hold on as long as I could, you know, hold out what the little stuff the Lord had blessed us with.
How did you decide it was time to leave?
When the water, I woke up about 2 o'clock in the morning checking things when I had the little pump pumping across the sandbag, and the water was coming down through the hole, so I had to do something fast then.
How do you feel right now? I mean, you haven't been back since May 19th. We're about to go see your place. Who knows what shape it's in? How are you feeling?
I feel kind of sad because, you know, my dad and mama, they built, had that house built and raised me and my brother and sister, and I've been in there and raised my son, he was 19 years old yesterday, and my daughter. I didn't want to put my children in danger, you know, going back and forth in this boat. Sometimes that little motor go out, we had to paddle, you know, so far.
Right, so, I mean, we're about to take a boat to your house because that's the only way we can get there.
That's the only way.
Anderson's home is underwater because this area is hemmed in on both sides by a ring of earthen levees. Think of the Yazoo backwater as a bathtub with a clogged drain. When the Mississippi River is this full, the water in the tub has nowhere to go.
Here come the boat.
It belongs to Anderson's friend, Way Windham. He's a soft-spoken man.
All right, can y'all get in?
Who helped put the sandbags around Anderson's house and checked on his dogs a few times. Windham puts an arm around Anderson, who's struggling to get aboard with crutches.
Let me move us out just a little bit.
The ride is a little more than a mile. We skim over farmland that looks like a lake. In 2008, the EPA vetoed a pumping project that had been planned for decades. The pumps would have sucked all this water out of the bathtub, but environmental groups said they'd also dry up pristine habitat for birds and fish. The project died, and people around here are still mad about it. Are we walking the rest of the way?
No, y'all stay in the boat.
So at this point, Wayne Windham has gotten out of the boat. We're close to Anderson's house, but the water's just a little bit too shallow for the outboard motor. We're on a gravel road, he's walking on a gravel road. We're floating above it in this boat. I'm passing a mailbox that's about 3 feet underwater. There's a home right in front of me that's inundated at floor level. Just passed a tractor that's sitting there doing absolutely nothing.
My sister and brother-in-law stayed right there. Yep, and that's my other sister's house in the middle right there, the two-trailer house.
Your whole family lives here?
Yeah.
This is your whole life?
It's my whole life, born and raised here. Yep, got some history here. And that blue house down there is mine.
A moment later, we're floating in front of Anderson's front door. A big, wild-eyed dog sees us before we see him.
Hey, Wolf.
Wolf is standing on the wall of sandbags. He's wet and filthy.
Pat! Pat!
Oh, there he is. Patch right there.
Where you at?
Come on, Pat. Come on, Pat.
Patch, the little one, runs across the top of the wall to greet us and then jumps down to take a drink. The water is black. Flies buzz at the surface. The dogs are stressed. They haven't seen Anderson in 16 days. But there are bigger problems.
You don't know good now.
Here we go. We're going to go inside the door now.
Yeah.
Okay, we're in your kitchen.
This is my kitchen right here.
We're about ankle deep, black water.
Yeah.
There's mold growing all over the countertops and the cupboards.
Yes. Oh, my new stove, all that.
We walk deeper inside the house. The air is thick. It's hot. Anderson's crutches click with every step in the sour hallway. Light filters through a window to show us the stagnant nightmare that is his daughter's bedroom.
Oh, boy.
Oh, man. Just dark.
Yeah.
There's no electricity.
Ain't no electricity.
You're hardly breathing here.
Yeah.
How you doing?
I'm doing pretty good. Trying not to shed no tears. It's just my playroom here.
I can't stand it in here anymore. I go to the door. But in the front yard, there are dangers too.
That was a hole.
Now the black water is in my boot. And on my pants. Way Windham is watching from the boat with a distant look on his face. He's near the sandbag levee that he helped build, thinking about why it failed.
When you put a ring levee around the house, you have to pump the rainwater out. And what happened here was pumps failed or whatever reason. Water got in the septic tank and came up through the plumbing and flooded the house.
That's what all the black water is?
That's what all the black water is. This is very unsanitary.
What are they going to do? I mean, this is a disaster.
I don't know that you wouldn't have to completely gut this house inside and out to start over. Or tear it down and maybe start over. Because I don't know that he'll be able to stay here. I don't think.
I mean, I'm worried about him just being in there.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's not safe walking around here. This is pretty much the worst of the worst right here.
Can I ask you a question?
Yes, sir.
Why did you take the time to help this man build a levee around his house?
Well, I mean, I care for, you know, fellow human beings. They don't have the financial means to build a levee like this. Anderson's been in a wreck. He's crippled up, and he barely gets around. So we came in on a tractor with a gooseneck trailer and hauled sandbags in there to get this up and get him situated. But, I mean, we did this because we live here, you know. We pass this house every day. They're friends of ours.
Been an emotional 4 months.
It has. It has. It's very emotional. You see some bad things. You see people that they don't have anywhere to go.
Anderson has a place to go, back to his sister's house in Jackson. If he's lucky, flood insurance will cover some of what it costs to rebuild. But first, the water needs to go down, and more rain is coming. These dogs can't stay here any longer. They won't survive. The men stuff two anxious dogs into one crate and load them onto the boat.
Don't stop, don't stop.
Anderson will bring Patch and Wolf to the abandoned building where he grew up, going to church. It's not far, but the land is dry on higher ground.
Oh yeah, they're gonna be okay. They protect each other.
He'll leave some food on a shaded porch step, and then he'll drive to his sister's place. When the water finally goes down, Anderson Jones says he'll come back.
Got to do like my dad, rebuild, because I know it needs fixing.
You think you can salvage that? I mean, there was mold hanging off the walls. There's sewage all over the place.
I'm going to have to clean it out, fix it over.
And maybe someday, his kids will do the same.
Because you got to teach your children, don't run every time something blow by. Keep what you got, because you can always say, ain't no place like home.
Don't run when you're scared.
Don't run when you're scared. All you gotta do is trust God.
For Here and Now, I'm Peter O'Dowd.
The Federal Communications Commission is taking action against robocalls. The agency voted unanimously yesterday to allow carriers to block spam calls by default rather than requiring customers to opt in to blocking services. Obviously, this is a familiar problem for all of us. Last month, Americans received nearly 5 billion robocalls. FCC Chairman Ajit Pai is calling them the scourge of civilization. NPR's Merritt Kennedy is covering the story. She joins us now. Hi, Merritt.
Hi, Jeremy.
So the FCC says that robocalls make up more than 60% of their complaints they receive each year. It doesn't surprise me because I get them all the time. Why has it taken so long for the agency to approve these new rules?
Right. Well, companies have actually in the past also said that they would like to take firmer action against robocalls. But the thing is, they've appeared somewhat reluctant to actually do so. And that's probably because it's not always easy to determine which calls consumers would actually want blocked. So it could be an illegal scam that's trying to get money out of you, or it could be a prescription reminder from a pharmacy that's dialing automatically. Or
so they wouldn't want to over-block the calls, you're saying, because maybe an important call is coming through and they don't want to be held responsible at the company, T-Mobile or AT&T or whatever, for blocking a call that you actually wanted.
Exactly. And what experts say is that is sometimes fairly difficult to determine.
So in this case, what exactly is going to change? Some carriers have already offered ways for customers to block calls on their own, but others haven't. What will be the situation now?
So the FCC is basically encouraging carriers to block robocalls. And they leave it up to the companies to decide, basically, which to block. And it's important to note that the FCC isn't mandating that companies have to do this. And, you know, we're talking about the question of liability. One big thing that is going to be important to companies is still working its way through a complicated rulemaking process. And that's whether companies who block calls using the authentication framework recommended by the FCC will be given safe harbor from lawsuits, because companies probably don't want to go to court for blocking a call that a consumer actually needs.
Right, exactly. And there's also a question of whether it's going to cost consumers money to have these call blocking services or whether they'll be free, right?
Yeah. So in its ruling, the FCC said that it expects carriers to offer the services for free, but that's really different than forcing them to do so. And one FCC commissioner, Jessica Rosenworcel, dissented over that part about cost. She said that she doesn't like the idea of the FCC forcing consumers to pay up, as she put it. So going down the road, it'll be interesting to see how consumers react to possible charges for these services that the companies are potentially rolling out as a default.
You know, these robocalls are annoying, that is for sure. But I guess in some ways, the reason that the FCC is stepping in here finally in this way is that they're probably cutting into U.S. productivity. People don't want to even answer the phone and take the chance that it's going to be a spam call. And maybe they're not doing a deal or you know, doing business that they should be doing because of that.
I mean, that certainly does seem likely. I know myself, I'm quite hesitant to answer the phone when I don't know the number.
Exactly. That is NPR's Merritt Kennedy on the new rules from the FCC involving robocalls. Merritt, thank you.
Thanks, Jeremy.
This week, the Trump administration imposed new restrictions on Americans traveling to Cuba, banning cruise trips and some popular forms of group travel to try and once again starve Cuba of American tourist dollars. The word I haven't used yet that is at the center of all this is Venezuela. The U.S. says Cuba is helping to prop up the Maduro regime in Caracas. Joining us now to talk about that is Brian Fonseca, who is the director of the Institute for Public Policy at Florida International University in Miami. He's got a paper coming out on this very topic soon at the Wilson Center. Brian, welcome to Here and Now.
Thanks for having me.
So let's talk about what the Trump administration has actually said here. They say that Cuba makes up the innermost circle of Venezuela's security apparatus. Here's the U.S. National Security Advisor, John Bolton, in an interview about this with Univision.
I think, honestly, if the 20 to 25,000 Cuban security forces that are in Venezuela today left tomorrow, Maduro would fall soon thereafter.
So is that true? Are there really 20 to 25,000 Cuban security forces in Venezuela today?
So, I mean, I highly doubt that. I did happen to participate in a study commissioned by Cynthia Arntzen at the Wilson Center that I co-authored with John Polga from the Naval Academy that really sort of dived into, you know, what do we know? And so our assessment at the end is that largely the numbers are exaggerated. I suspect that if you tried to lump all Cubans operating in Venezuela to include humanitarian professionals, teachers, others that may be working, you know, in sort of the social environment, you might be able to get to 20, 25,000. But it's highly unlikely that you have 20 to 25,000 pure security and intelligence professionals operating on the ground in Venezuela.
But are a lot of the people in the security apparatus in Venezuela Cuban?
Certainly the inner circle. So from our findings, and we conducted countless interviews with experts, both American, Venezuelan, Cuban, those that have served in the Venezuelan military and have firsthand knowledge of Cuban presence. And so, you know, in terms of the depth of their role, I think the National Security Advisor is correct in suggesting that they comprise the innermost circle mm-hmm. of the Venezuelan leadership. After the 2002 attempt to unseat former President Hugo Chavez, he turned to Cuba to further sort of firewall his regime or coup-proof his government from internal and external pressures to unseat him. At that point, we started to see Cubans surrounding Chavez as part of his inner security and reporting a lot of that information back to, you know, to Chavez and subsequently Maduro.
So why would that help them? Why wouldn't they be able to coup-proof themselves by using Venezuelans?
Well, because part of the challenge is the fear of, sort of an interruption of power from within governing institutions, namely the military institution, right? And so, you know, as part of coup-proofing, things that you might do is create rivalries or factions between the branches, create deep distrust among military professionals to try to stop them from moving forward with big orchestrated, you know, well-thought-out, well-oiled plans to
disrupt government. And it's easier to do that with people from the outside than from the inside, you're saying?
Yeah, absolutely. I think the penetration of security and intelligence professionals really begins to take after, again, the 2002 event that unseated Chavez briefly. I think at that point, you know, Chavez found that there were a lot within the military institution, within the economic elite, that wanted to see him removed from office. And he consulted heavily with Fidel Castro to ensure that, you know, preservation of the regime was at the top of the agenda. And I think Castro, to some degree, saw this also as an opportunity, you know, to sort of mentor the future, you know, someone that would maybe carry on that sort of socialist, 21st century socialist project.
So they agreed on the politics there, but there's also an economic aspect to this, which is that
absolutely
Venezuela is a huge oil producer, and they've been providing Cuba with oil, cheap oil, in exchange for Cuba sending people over to Venezuela.
Absolutely. This is not purely about ideological affinity, right? I mean, there is a pragmatic aspect to the relationship, and that pragmatism is centered in exactly what you say, sort of the exchange for services, not just military and intelligence services, but humanitarian, right? Sort of health, doctors,
right,
teachers, services in exchange for, you know, oil.
Venezuelans, or if you ask the Cubans, they may say right now, well, that's all we're sending. We're only sending over doctors and teachers.
Right. And again, you know, sort of based on our findings, you know, we conclude there's still an important presence there. And you sort of see it manifest. I think there was reporting about Maduro's trip to the UN earlier this year, being surrounded by Cuban security professionals. You know, the U.S. Southern Command Combatant Commander Admiral Fowler has gone, you know, and testified before Congress and talked about that role that the Cubans play in terms of providing internal security, which is really important. Again, this is about firewalling sort of the regime, those, you know, at the top of government from the prospects of those that might attempt to unseat him or others within what I call kleptocracy, right?
So let's talk about Cuba for a second, because the situation in Cuba, it sounds like, is getting worse economically. There are reports of food shortages and rationing of basic goods like rice and soap. Is Cuba now at risk, for a number of reasons, of becoming the next Venezuela?
Yeah, I think you're right. To the degree, not sure, but certainly scholars are suggesting, sort of observers are suggesting, that Cuba may have entered its new special period. And what that means is that, you know, similar to the 90s, a period in which Cuba is losing the economic support of external actors and not really generating enough, you know, sort of domestic revenue to sustain, you know, a healthy economy. So it is certainly struggling. And I think from data that we found, sort of economic data, we've seen a decline in what Venezuela has been able to provide to Cuba. And so certainly Cuba is, you know, in a very tough socioeconomic position. I think it's completely aware of that. But another angle to this, I think, is also, you know, fascinating at least to think about, is the prospects that Cuba is also concerned about, you know, efforts from the United States to disrupt its political model. And maybe by keeping the United States engaged in Venezuela, at least in the interim, might give Cuba some space to continue to, you know, to sort of survive. Certainly not thrive, but survive. So the U.S. policy seems to be focused, you know, on Venezuela clearly, and we're hearing a lot in Venezuela because of the dire humanitarian crisis. And I think it certainly merits the attention that the United States is placing. You know, but when you listen to sort of U.S. policymakers, it's sort of an expanded approach that is also inclusive of Nicaragua and Cuba. I think Venezuela and Cuba probably more so, but certainly I think if I recall, National Security Advisor Bolton in Miami sort of, you know, first launched the term, you know, the troika of tyranny, right, when talking about sort of U.S. policy towards the hemisphere from Miami.
Do you see any scenario in which the U.S. is able to squeeze Cuba enough that Cuba helps to remove finally Maduro from power in Venezuela?
You know, it's a great question. I know it's been batted around sort of what role could Cuba play in helping you know, sort of dislodge Maduro and more than Maduro, right? Sort of those that are in that inner circle, Diosdado Cabello, Tariq, and others. A lot of questions about what role Cuba could play. More importantly, what role would Cuba play? knowing that, you know, they are facing a very hostile U.S. administration right now, one that seems to be, historically speaking, more hardline, right, and almost sort of demanding, you know, some type of change. And I think those at the helm of U.S. policy in this particular space, and it's hard to pick just one, but when you look at those that may be sitting in the NSC, Mauricio Claver, you know, the role that Senator Marco Rubio is playing, you know, these are those that have focused their respective professional careers on Cuba. And so I think there's certainly some concern. Not sure if the United States will be able to court Cuba or, you know, sort of use a stick with Cuba to get them to back away from Maduro. But certainly I think that there is a wrinkle. You're starting to see wrinkles, at least, in Maduro's role in Venezuela, and I think it's probably short-lived anyhow.
That is Brian Fonseca, who is director of the Institute for Public Policy at Florida International University. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
The summertime used to bring TV doldrums, a time for reruns and game shows. But now it's brimming with new programs, and that means it's not giving NPR's TV critic Eric Dickens any summer break at all.
None at all.
Not at all, but it's giving you a lot to talk about. Why don't you start off with HBO's returning to its drama, Big Little Lies, this coming Sunday.
Yeah, so this initially was supposed to be a limited series, something that kind of appeared last year, and then it wouldn't happen again, particularly because they had so many stars in it, including Reese Witherspoon and Nicole Kidman. But it did so well that they decided to try and bring it back again for another season, and Meryl Streep joins the cast. Now, if you haven't watched all of the show, I'm going to talk about the details of the plot, so it's a spoiler alert, but basically, last season, we had these five women kind of come together. One of them was being regularly beaten by her husband, and they get into a confrontation at a party, and another one of them pushes him down a flight of stairs, and he dies. So Meryl Streep plays the mother of that husband, and we have a clip where Meryl Streep's character threatens to go to the police while she's talking to Nicole Kidman's character. Let's check it out.
I'll go to the police.
What?
To get some answers.
You left some things out, didn't you? The fact that he fathered another child, you left that out. That you planned to move, that you rented an apartment, you left that out. And that you learned of his infidelity just 10 seconds before he went falling down a flight of stairs to his death. Oh, you left that out.
Yeah. So
wow.
Any mother who could produce a son like the husband who was beating on Nicole Kidman, you got to wonder about that mother, right? So the most interesting part of this story is the journey of Nicole Kidman's character. She's having grief and loss, but also feeling abused and trying to recover from that. It's a very interesting story to play out.
Speaking, though, of returning to dramas, Hulu came out with the third season of The Handmaid's Tale this week. It has been a critical darling, but it's now expanded past the original Margaret Atwood scope. How does the show feel now as it's into its third season?
Well, the challenge with The Handmaid's Tale, you know, this is a show that's set in a theocracy where women are forced to serve as breeders for the ruling class. The second season was expanding that world a little more and letting us see beyond the boundaries of the house where the main character, Elizabeth Moss's character, was imprisoned. Now in the third season, they're expanding it more. We have a clip of a scene where she's arguing with the wife of the commander who was her original owner. Elizabeth Moss's character, Offred, used an underground network to sneak her away to Canada. We have this clip. Let's check it out.
You wanted a better life for her, and that is what a mother does for her child.
You gave her to a murderer. You killed my baby. You killed my baby. How could you take her away from me?
Because I have another daughter. You chased us in the woods and you hunted us down with dogs. And when you pulled her away, she screamed. My baby screamed for her mother. And I hope this feels like that.
So, yeah, a powerful scene. And, you know, so in a society where the handmaids, the women who are forced to bear children, are sort of on the bottom rung and they have no compunction about hurting or terrorizing or torturing these people, it strains that these totalitarian rulers would allow her to operate the way she does in this world. And that's the thing that distracts me the most when I'm watching this third season.
So Netflix and Letterman have a show out. My next guest needs no introduction. He's managed to get vulnerable admissions from those he's had on the show, including Kanye West, who we're going to hear right now, talking about his experiences with mental illness.
Everyone now is an actor. Everything is a conspiracy. You feel the government is putting chips in your head. You feel you're being recorded. You feel all of these things.
And these are vividly realistic to you.
Yes. And they have this moment where they put you, they handcuff you, they drug you, they put you on the bed, and they separate you from everyone you know.
What do you make of that, Eric, of the discussion?
Yeah, that's an affecting clip. Basically, the first season, David Letterman was interviewing people that he seemed to be comfortable with. He had Barack Obama on. He had Howard Stern on. And those conversations were interesting, but they weren't particularly revelatory. Now he's having conversations with people he may not know that well, but he's very interested in them, and he gets them to reveal things that they haven't necessarily talked about in other spaces. So people may joke about Kanye West acting crazy. But in this interview, Kanye West talks about being mentally ill, talks about taking a medication for it, talks about wondering about whether or not his creativity will be stifled by it. And Ellen DeGeneres also has an interview where she talks about being molested by her stepfather, which she's disclosed in the past, but she talks about it in a bit more detail and talks about why it's important for her to come forward to get people to believe women when they come forward and talk about being victims of abuse. So this is Letterman taking something that seemed like a one-off, something that he was kind of doing to while away his retirement, and turning it into serious television. And that's why I think this season of his show is so special.
Well, summertime TV isn't what it used to be.
It certainly isn't. And I assure you, there's fun shows coming, but these are the shows that are debuting right at the beginning of the TV season. And they're a little serious, but they're also really interesting.
NPR TV critic Eric Dickens. Thanks a lot, Eric.
Always a pleasure.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Lisa Mullins.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.